will thicken, the rain will spread up from the south, and it will continue to be heavy at times, particularly across eastern Scotland throughout the afternoon. Highs here of 6 to 7 degrees. Hopefully a dry and brighter day on Sunday. That's your forecast.
Thanks, Nina. Nina Ridge there at the BBC Weather Centre. Now on Radio 4, our Book of the Week, and more from the story of an English woman in occupied France. The Allies advance, daily life is as difficult as ever, and another suitor emerges from the past as Nicholas Shakespeare reads Priscilla.
D-Day caught Priscilla in Le Havre with Otto Graebner. He had hastened to the port to supervise the onward passage of a precious cargo of paintings, stolen masters belonging to Hermann Göring. Once the bombing started, Priscilla's priority became to leave Le Havre, where she had travelled in a great state of anguish after receiving Robert's latest refusal to divorce. Graebner's last protective act was to deploy a young Spaniard to accompany Priscilla on her epic bicycle ride back to Paris. It was a terrorising journey. Everywhere lorries on their side, and the smell of putrefying flesh and cordite. A fortnight after the Normandy landings, the RAF bombed the oil depots at the docks in Saint-Ouen, once the centre of Bureau Otto's operations. Priscilla may have escaped the bombs, but she could not escape what was waiting for her at the end of that liberation cycle ride, as she called it. When he heard the news, Pierre set out from his home in Annemasse. One morning in early July, a knock on her door at her clinic in Paris. Pierre, holding a cage with a canary inside. Pierre slept in Priscilla's room, the tiny yellow bird shuttling from its perch to the bars. A hysterectomy meant Priscilla would never have children. Her illness, operation, and convalescence played out against the Allied advance. A nurse smuggled in a wireless so that Priscilla could tune in to the BBC. Priscilla was too frail to move. Otto Graebner appeared at her bedside to say goodbye. On another day, Robert appeared and made a scene. No one was more upset with Priscilla than Daniel Vernier, Pierre's brother-in-law. Vernier walked in unannounced to catch Priscilla in the arms of Pierre. Pierre wanted Daniel to be the first to know. Priscilla and he were getting married, and they were giving an engagement party next week. Daniel rushed from the room. What Pierre intended to say to his wife is anyone's guess. Priscilla loved Pierre, but their time together was almost up. Their engagement party postponed indefinitely by street celebrations featuring columns of excitable young men chanting the Marseillaise. On the 12th of August 1944, as the Abwehr began shredding its secret files, the boulevards were choked with hundreds of vehicles departing for Germany. The Allies had landed unopposed in the south of France. Pierre was agitating to get back to his wife and children. Bedridden, Priscilla could not join in the delirious crowds of more than a million who cheered de Gaulle on foot down the Champs-Élysées on the 26th of August. When dusk fell, men and women paired off. Beneath the chestnuts in the Bois de Boulogne, on the warm grass in the Jardin des Plantes, couples made love. On the night when Paris made love, Priscilla was alone in her room. Pierre had returned to Annemasse. Suddenly next morning, everyone woke up in the resistance. Outside Priscilla's window roamed up to 60,000 ill-disciplined men and women, dressed in white armbands with the initials FFI for Force Française de l'Intérieur embroidered on them, clutching guns, animated by the slogan À chacun son Boche, to each his own German. Women who had slept with Germans presented the readiest target for a nation in need of a symbolic act of purification. Up to 20,000 women that summer had their heads shaved. Her hair. Her famous hair. Pierre had promised to look after her. Where was he? Overnight, the men who might have helped Priscilla had melted away. Otto gone. Pierre gone. Emile still in Fresnes prison. Danielle and Robert hurt beyond measure. She was an obvious target for revenge. Not of French origin, well-fed and dressed because of her association with Germans. She had lain beside Otto Graebner's warm fire while the rest of France shivered. Priscilla was in her room one evening when the door was flung open and Daniel Vernier marched in, dressed in uniform, and produced with an extremely shaky hand a revolver which he pointed at her. I hadn't noticed the FFI band on his arm until then and thought he'd come to murder me. She stared back into the muzzle of Vernier's trembling gun. Vernier turned on his heels, walked away. Soon afterwards, a nurse came into the room with a letter from Pierre. You will know what it costs me to write this word of farewell. She closed her eyes and felt something inside her tear apart. Early in October 1944, Priscilla moved back into her garçonnière in Place Saint-Augustin. She was sitting in her coat, reading, beside the single-bar electric heater, when there was a knock on the door. A tall officer introduced himself in a sing-song English voice as Harold Acton, a friend of Gillian Sutro's. Over a big tin of caviar and champagne, consumed in a freezing room, Acton told Priscilla of Gillian's concern for her during the last 4.5 years, and produced the letter in which, Gillian wrote, I had offered to harbour her while she sorted herself out. The war was still raging. To leave Paris was very difficult. Acton passed on the message that if Priscilla needed assistance, she was to contact Gillian's sister, Jacqueline Hammond, at the British Embassy, which was now reopened. On Saturday, the 21st of October, Priscilla boarded the King's Messenger plane for Hendon. Priscilla had packed Pierre's letters into her suitcase, along with clothes which Otto Graebner had given her, plus the intimate correspondence and photographs of the men she had known in the occupation. S.B.B. Macy's diary records his first post-war meeting with Priscilla, his daughter. 9th of November, an eventful day. First time I've seen her for 5 years. She told us her story at night. 3 months in concentration camp. Then 3.5 years on false papers, living with Spaniards, Belgians, Swiss. But S.B.B.'s elation was short-lived. She cares nothing for anything except having a good time. I'm desperately sorry for her. Priscilla had escaped Paris with a suitcase. Within weeks, she was in bed with Robert Donat, England's leading man in this golden age of British cinema. Donat was enchanted. But Priscilla disappeared on him, involved with the secretive book she was writing. A visit to London in November 1945 persuaded her husband Robert that Priscilla would never come back to France with him. Robert consented to a civil dissolution of their marriage. Priscilla was free after 8.5 years of a celibate and childless union. In October 1947, Gillian and Priscilla took the Golden Arrow to Saint-Maxime for a fortnight's holiday, stopping off in Paris. It was their first time together in France since 1940. At a party, Priscilla met Raymond Thompson. Like everyone she knew, she talked of anything but the occupation. Their marriage on the 4th of June 1948 at Caxton Hall Register Office in Westminster attracted headlines. Vicomtesse weds. Bride was in Gestapo jail. In the evening, Raymond drove Priscilla in his silver Lancia, to their new home in Sussex by the sea. Priscilla started to write in secret, in the hope of understanding those things which had always troubled her. But in order to keep Raymond's protection, she had to remain mute, and in a place called Wittering. Many of the significant emotional moments of Priscilla's life had occurred in wartime France, but her French years fell into the category of a shameful subject. No one was going to want to read about Priscilla's war. As Gillian pointed out, Besançon was not Auschwitz. Her experience was not one of victory over the enemy, but of personal defeat. The story of Priscilla's adulteries would have been incomprehensible. After Belsen was liberated in April 1945 and the public saw the newsreels, it became unthinkable to admit to any intimacies with the Germans. Priscilla was torn between two opposing impulses, between feeling that she had to shut away what she had written in the chest beneath the television, and wishing for it to be broadcast. She completed her first article, describing her imprisonment at Besançon, 6 weeks after landing in London. She sent the manuscript to SPB, hoping that her father might find a publisher. Priscilla's story was her heart's blood, and she felt brutally rejected when she received a reply not from SPB, but a brush-off from her stepmother, Winnie. Her father's rejection was the most cruel, but it anticipated the reaction of every publisher to whom she offered her work. Everything that Priscilla was obsessed to gather together in her padded chest braided into the same story. The drama of a woman with a past nobody was interested in, not even her own father, but who was compelled to write it down, however incriminating. When Priscilla flew back to England in October 1944, she had brought with her out of France material for a cracking story, not about an elite coming to terms with fascism, but about ordinary people, ordinary women especially, adjusting, screwing up, and developing survival skills of a deeply primitive and totally understandable, if ruthless, kind. When Priscilla's novel reached the scene where Daniel Vernier lowered his pistol inside the clinic in Saint-Cloud, it disintegrated into a mass of notes and scribbles. Survivors pay with their conscience. Not to Raymond, not to Gillian, did Priscilla admit the extent of her friendships with Émile Cornet, Max Stocklin, and Otto Graebener. Nailed to the cross of her secret past, she preserved the silence of Garbo on her years in occupied France. Priscilla had held her shame at bay through the 1940s and 50s, but it was eating away inside. After a visit to Church Farm, SBB wrote in his diary, "Too much gin, as usual." From the early 1960s, the sadness that I had picked up on as a child started to reveal itself. Each new stage of Priscilla's decline was inexorable. Raymond finally wrote to Gillian in March 1982. "Priscilla died last night of a malignant brain tumour. Although you were for very many years her closest friend, she did not want me to tell you that she was dying. Love, Raymond." Priscilla was 65.
Nicholas Shakespeare was reading from his recent book Priscilla, which was abridged for radio by Katrin Williams. The series producer was Duncan Minchell. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday, the 18th of January. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Fisher, Trafalgar, Fitzroy, Rockall, Fair Isle, Faroes, and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Fitzroy 989, expected Irish Sea 983 by 1800 on Saturday. New low expected Rockall 982 by same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours: Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, northeast 40s. Southeasterly 7 to severe gale 9, increasing storm 10 at times, except in North Utsira. Rain at times, moderate or poor. Southwest 40s, Cromarty.